Greetings, listeners, and welcome to another episode of The Story Never Ends, the podcast where we reread our favorite books and watch their adaptations, and sometimes just watch their adaptations. I'm Audrey.
And I'm Tinashe.
In this episode, we once again take a detour from our Harry Potter discussions to focus on other films that have taken our interest recently. So we'll be discussing the recent 2022 Netflix adaptation of Jane Austen's Persuasion. And without further ado, let us break down Persuasion. So I guess, I don't know if you want to just touch on a little bit regarding the background of Persuasion, like whatever you might know, but I just sort of thought we could just, you know, that way, at least if there's a listener that's just interested to know what we might be talking about, they understand why we're talking about this film.
Yeah. Persuasion is a book by Jane Austen.
Yep.
Can start with that.
And it was published in 1817 as well, as one of her last completed novels as well, apparently. Yeah.
I actually, like, I was looking at Wikipedia, and I don't know if she wrote Northanger Abbey and Persuasion at the same time or something.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay. But I don't want to lie. I'm just looking at Wikipedia. Yeah.
I went on there just for the synopsis as well. Like, I just was like, because essentially the synopsis says, the story concerns Anne Elliot, a young English woman of 27 years whose family moved to lower their expenses and reduce their debt by renting their home to an admiral and his wife. The wife's brother, Navy Captain Frederick Wentworth, was engaged to Anne in 1806, but the engagement was broken when Anne was persuaded by her friends and family to end their relationship. Anne and Captain Wentworth, both single and unattached, meet again after a seven-year separation, setting the scene for many humorous encounters, as well as a second well-considered chance at love and marriage for Anne in her second bloom. Although, mind you, this is not the synopsis from the book or anything. I mean, this is not the blurb. I just thought it summarizes.
Is this from Wikipedia? Like, I was reading it word for word as well.
I just copied it and I thought it's pretty good for us to at least, without us, because we run the risk of then getting into the breakdown of the film. So I just thought, let's give the general thing. Yeah. And it's been adapted multiple times for theatre, for TV, for film, even for radio. One of my favourite things about Jane Austen's works is they've just multiple audio book versions or audio adaptations, right, that have been done. There's like abridged versions, which is the one I've listened to. It had like, do you know the lady, have you ever watched Bend It Like Beckham?
Yes.
Keira Knightley's mum's character. Like, the actress's name is Juliet Stevenson. She's the one that plays Anne Elliot in the radio adaptation of.
But you said that's Keira Knightley's mum?
Isn't that Keira Knightley's mum? Juliet Stevenson?
I don't know. I don't know. I'm like, that's
No, in real life. As in Keira Knightley's character's mum in Bend It Like Beckham. Yeah. I just was trying to ring where you might have seen her from. But that's the adaptation I have listened to. So, disclaimer, I have not read Persuasion, but I've watched most of the adaptations and have...
I thought you read it.
No, I actually didn't. I remember when you were saying, let's reread. I was like, I've never actually read the book. I've just read the adaptation. No, sorry. I've listened to the audiobook of it, but it was also an abridged version. So it wasn't like word for word, whatever Anne's thinking.
Yes.
But the only reason I haven't read it is because I've been holding out for so long because I know it's such a good book and I need time. Yeah. So...
Yes.
Anyway, so sorry, fans. I'm not like, you know, going to be criticizing every word for word adaptation. I mean, translation to screen. I'm just more so going off the existing adaptations and my understanding of the story. So
Yes, and with adaptations, like I was listening to someone else saying that, you know, you're gonna have to allow for certain things that will not be adapted word for word into film, scene for scene into the film. But in its essence, is it telling the story the way it's meant to be told? And that's what I am looking at. I want to say I've read the book, but it was a very long time ago. Very long time ago. Film wise, I had definitely seen the 2007 several times. And 1995 one, that's the one I watched today.
So was it for the first time watching the 1995
one? I've tried watching it before, but I think I just felt so old, the cinematography of it, it just felt so old. So I couldn't get into it. I couldn't get into the characters, but I wish I had given it a chance before. I did kind of enjoy it.
Because for me, it's the opposite. Like 1995, I've rinsed and repeated, like I said. 2007 is only because I don't think I could access it after a while. Like, you know how we can only now, hopefully no one is listening, from the production company, but your version is not available anyway, like to actually legitimately access it. It's only on this Dailymotion thing, unless you have
I watched it from YouTube, the whole thing. But
no, no, 2007 one, not 1995.
Oh, yes,
yeah, because 2007 I can't find it anywhere, like even Stan or like Netflix, because even that, what happened for me was I actually watched 2007 first before I watched 1995, because what I was on this. BBC has periods, right, where it releases these TV movies. So 1960s, 70s, 80s, they've released these movies up to the 90s as well, where they did the 1995 Persuasion and 1995 Pride and Prejudice. But then the 1995 Sense and Sensibility was like a theatrical film, so it wasn't like part of their like slate of films. But then in 2007, they were honouring Jane Austen. I don't know if it was like a commemoration of her death or something, and they released a slate of her films. So that's how I actually watched Mansfield Park, Northanger Abbey, the one with J.J. Fielding,
yes,
whatever.
Yes, I love that one. Yes.
Of course, Emma as well. Emma was really well done. And although at the time I actually didn't like Emma as much, so I never gave it a chance until, yeah, somewhere down the line. Anyway, and then obviously Persuasion. So that's how I watched Persuasion. And then I discovered there was a whole other slate of films, and I went back and watched the 1995 one and all that stuff. But so I'm guessing your favorite adaptation is 2007.
Mine would
be the 1995. But literally, we'll get into why all these adaptations, I think, reign supreme in some ways when we are talking. But yeah, I thought let's just do that. And now I guess let's focus a little bit more on 2022 Persuasion, which stars Dakota Johnson, and I think his name is Cosmo Jarvis, I think, the lead actor, and as well as Henry Golding, and a few other mentions, I think. Richard Grant or something, I can't remember. Anyway, but it's got some prominent. We could just Google this, but I just can't be bothered.
Honestly, I recognized three of them: Dakota and Henry Golding. The actor who plays Wentworth, I recognize him by face. I don't know where I've seen him in, but name I couldn't even
that
tell
was
you.
The first time I've ever seen that guy. I was like, wait, what? Who are you?
I feel like I've seen him in something else. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, it stars those big names, and it is the first, I could say, major release outside of like the BBC slate for Persuasion. That is because it seems it has only been a TV movie specifically for the BBC. So now this is the first time they've done a major. It wasn't theatrical, I suppose, but on Netflix streaming, all that stuff. And I guess what are your general thoughts on the film before we really dig deep?
I just have one general thought. Like, after watching the trailer, right, I'm like, I'm gonna go into this with low expectations, and that has really worked well for me so far. Like, when I went to watch Top Gun, low expectations, and was pleasantly surprised, more than pleasantly surprised. So with this one, I was like, you know, I'm not going to expect too much from it after hearing the words axes and single and whatnot. So my headcanon before I even started was, this is a modern adaptation of the book. It's a fanfic of a modern woman falling into an 18th century romance. And honestly, it actually did help me kind of enjoy this movie.
and those are my thoughts.
Otherwise, I feel like I would have been probably like maybe the Jane Austen purist counterparts. They would have been really disappointed with this. Yeah. That's not to say I wasn't kind of disappointed with some of the things that happened in this movie. But part of me was like, it is what it is.
You know what? That's great to you because you're much stronger than me. I'm just kidding. But to be honest, that's what happened. I watched the trailer, absolutely mortified. I was like, what are we going to get? And when we had the conversation afterwards, I was like, low expectations as possible. And I think, to be honest, disclaimer to everyone, I'm not approaching this from a don't watch this movie, whatever. I actually think the more we get of like the works of these classical, you know, old age artists and authors, the better it is for these works to like stay alive, right? Because otherwise you've got so many great works. Like, there's some books and stuff that have been around forever, but they've barely been adapted because, you know, there's just not interest in that particular world. But then you've got your timeless pieces that always get adapted, and Jane Austen thankfully falls into that regardless of which type of medium you're consuming her in. So I'm very much appreciative that we once again get something from her. And through the discourse that I was listening to, like, people saying it, I've just gained like an appreciation of what everyone is talking about. There's some people that are like, you know, we just wanted what we get in the book to be translated to screen. And some are saying, obviously, we understand that the translation can't be word for word or capture the essence all the way, but at least it should have leaned in more into the themes that are in the original book. And obviously some people are saying we appreciate the modernization, but then some people are saying, well, it's too much of like a riff on Pride and Prejudice and Emma. So there's all these thoughts, and I'll get into my thoughts later. But really, just looking at the what makes up a film, cinematography, script, whatever, whatever, I would say for me it was a middling film, because removing myself from knowing what Persuasion is and what it does, I sort of was thinking, if I was just an average person watching this, would I be moved by this film? And no, I wouldn't be. As in, would I be someone who's like, I'm going to come back and I'm going to watch and fall in love with Wentworth again? No, I wouldn't be.
No.
It had colourful, you know, a colourful palette, let's say. You know, it was kind of like Emma in the feel in Pride and Prejudice movies that have like really beautiful cinematography. It was really good. It had committed actors. Obviously, everyone was acting as they were supposed to, but I just think... And I love the colorblind casting, obviously, but because for me, the source material is so specific, it lacked that wow factor, because you're taking a period piece and, like you said, you're turning it into fan fiction rather than turning a period piece and honoring what it is and enhancing it through some other medium, like this modernization that they were doing. So I think, like I said, middling film because of that. And my general thoughts are way more than your one specific point.
That's all right.
For me, things like costuming, like things that even the anachronisms that were supposed to be funny, for example, they just weren't funny. I use an example of, do you know the movie A Knight's Tale? It was like Heath Ledger, one of his most prominent movies. I would recommend you watch it whenever. It's a comedy. It's just about Heath Ledger as a character. I don't think he falls back in time, but it's set in like a world of like knights and, you know, ladies and all that stuff, the Middle Ages, but it's modern. It's got like rock and pop and all this stuff, but it just works for what it was. Even Ellen Enchanted, one of like Anne Hathaway's movies before Princess Diaries, whatever. It's the same thing. They've got like We Will Rock You in that movie and like whatever, one of the Queen songs. But it just works because they lean into what they're doing. And actually, maybe those works were served better because I don't think they were like a literal adaptation of something. But for what Persuasion was trying to do, have playlist and all this stuff, I did appreciate some of those things. I was like, oh, okay, that's cool. Having a playlist, you know, it's it is a playlist. It just touches on our modern understanding of what a playlist is, but still has that. I appreciated those little things, but then for some reason it just kind of made Persuasion a joke rather than this.
It was a comedy. It really was.
And not in a good way as well. Like it wasn't like how Emma, 2020 Emma, made the humor and whatever that is already in Emma more like something you can appreciate. You kind of took Persuasion and said, oh, this is too serious. We're just going to make it funny or whatever. So we'll touch on that later. And then also I didn't like that, or general thoughts wise, I didn't like how they changed some of the story threads, and we'll touch on them as we go on. That just made it not make sense by the end as to why characters are doing whatever they're doing. Mm-hmm. And honestly, the fundamental thing for me was there was no chemistry between the leads, and I just could not stand the fact that
some moments I'm like, I like that. Then some moments I'm like, I'm not feeling anything happening here. Is it just me? Am I not? I don't know what it was.
2007, Sally Hawkins and Rupert Penry Jones, I think is his name. So good. Kieran Hines for me and Amanda Root, 1995. So good. And it's the moments, it's the touches and the looks. And anyway, touch it on later. But otherwise, yes. And I could say, before we maybe just break it down more, because it will probably turn more negative, especially for myself, are there any things that you appreciated not specific, but like just, is there anything you appreciated?
I just want to say one thing that what you're talking about, like the modernism and not fitting with the type of story that was Persuasion set in. It's like the movie had not met the powers that be, did not make a decision to say, we're going to make this a modern story or make this like, you know, an 18th century romance story. It's like they wanted to take one thing here and there from each time period and not actually commit to one or the other. And it does not work for a movie setting in this time period. So what you get used to the, you know, but we get into it. But that scene when the people coming to debt collectors or whatever, I don't know. And then the girl is like, oh, what is happening? Why not? And the man is like, your daddy did not. I'm like, what?
I didn't even catch that because I'm supposed to be tuned out as hell.
But something that I enjoyed, and I said mine was more, I did too enjoy the what you call it? The diverse cast. I did not expect it. Was it in the trailer? Or I just forgot it? I don't know.
In the trailer. But obviously, we all modified at the trailer. I don't think we even remembered what was what.
It was quite surprising. But I also, I'm like, you know, I don't mind this. I enjoyed it. And Henry Golding, man. I'm like, that man is handsome. That man is fine. But he was able to become like, you know, like not a villain. What would you call him? He's not a villain. Just a bad guy.
Yeah, I suppose. But he's your Wickham. He's use. Your Wickham, yeah. But... you know,
yeah, Wickham kind of character, and I kind of enjoyed him a little bit. Sometimes I was getting not pulled in, like because I knew, like what his character was, unlike in Sanditon. But I'm like, he actually managed to make himself almost not appealing or attractive, but he is attractive. Yeah, yeah, his character, but yeah, it is what it is. Let's get into it.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, for me, appreciation was the nod to the 2007 with the run. Like, at the end when Ayn runs in the 2007 movie, they kind of had a... I suppose, I don't know, maybe it's a source-based thing, but I just kind of take it as a nod to the 2007 one, although the 2007 had too much running for my liking, to be honest. But anyway, it was, like, kind of nice to sort of have... because in 1995, there's no running. They just sort of, like, meet and...
No, yeah, they remember, just walk yeah, so off, yeah.
Kind of
yeah.
Thought, and then, obviously, I like that... even in the sea of no chemistry, there were still moments where you recognize Wentworth recognizing Anne's strength, especially like very rare moment really, but when Louisa does the fall and then he's like, Anne is the most suited to take care of her, whatever. Kind of just appreciated that as a moment, because literally that was like one of the only moments I was like, oh, okay, we get something.
I had one or two moments when he would look at her. I think there's a moment, especially when they're in what do I want to say? Cornwall. It's not Cornwall.
It is Lyme is in Cornwall, isn't it?
Is it?
Yeah, I think so.
I did not.
I'm not British, but in Lyme, I think it is.
And yeah, at that dinner, and Anne is talking to Benwick, and Wentworth is overhearing that conversation. There's a certain look in his eye that I'm like, see, I was trying to find moments here and there where like I could sense romance,
a haystack where I could sense
attraction. And you know when you're watching a movie or TV show and the guy looks at the girl, like, you know, and you know that he loves it, that he wants it. There's a certain look in his eye, and you're just like,
Anthony Bridgerton. That's all we gotta
right?
say.
Right,
Matthew McFadden in Mr. Darcy in 2000. Mr. Darcy, you know, like Colin Firth, for Christ's sake, when he's sitting across from her when she's on the piano and he just cannot help but look at Elizabeth. Anyway,
like the other people in the room, guys.
Literally, you're almost embarrassed because you're like, am I invading on her private? But yeah, anyway, what we're trying to just emphasize, I guess, is there was not really as much of that. So now, specifics, let's get into the specifics, girl. Mm-hmm. Break it down for me.
You take it away.
I think we'll. Forgive us, listeners, this is not like we haven't broken it down like in some perfect order of like from start to finish, right? We're just sort of getting into each point and jumping on each other, like jumping from each other's points, right? And we'll just sort of
go around. Bouncing off each other.
I think specifics, if you want me to sort of start, really, it was specifically going on the modernization. I think if there's one thing, I didn't say it in the appreciation side of things, but I would say now as a more specific point, I did enjoy the modernization insofar as it served to sort of just highlight some of the quirkiness of Austin's world. Like I said, the fact that she says, oh, he made me a playlist. It actually makes sense because it is a playlist of songs that they actually play.
That took me out. Like, I'm like, playlist?
I know. Like, playlist? There are things that took me out, but I could reflect back on and say, oh, kind of makes sense. You know, like, as in, for what they were trying to do. Because right? Like you said, if you go into this movie thinking, I know, don't want any of this, I want just persuasion as it is, you will be very disappointed. But because, to be honest, most of the movie, I did not react to anything. I more so chuckled at certain points. And one of those points was Mary. If there's one modernization or characterization I appreciated, it's that of Mary, like Mary Elliot, and sister.
Yeah.
Because the way they caricatured her, whatever the word is.
Yeah, yeah. Like how she'd say, how Anne would be like, now she, I'm going to speak in Italian, and was it Italian or Spanish? And she's just going to continue talking, and she won't even realize that.
Because it fits into what we kind of see her being of most of the adaptations anyway, and it makes sense for her. So that's my point. I don't want to keep going, but yeah.
For me, it was the language, as we see in the trailer and in the movie, like the mixing of the 18th century English and the modern way of speaking. Like, for example, she's like, now I'm single and thriving. And there's the other men, the debt collectors, as I was saying, they're like, they're this broke princess. Who's talking
did
like that?
Did they actually say that? I did not even catch that, honestly.
The exes running gag. And the funny thing is, in the 2000 version, we're not doing like comparing adaptations, but...
We kind of are, to be honest with you. I think I very much have a lot of more comparisons sometimes.
Oh, so okay.
Feel free.
But it was funny to me, like, in the 2007 version, Anne does say the line, we are worse than strangers. But then she goes on to say, for we may never be acquainted.
Because that is exactly from the book. That is a line from Jane Austen.
Even if it wasn't, it fits with the language.
Exactly. Exactly.
It fits with the language.
You're right. Yeah. It's like, I don't watch period dramas to be reminded that I live in the modern world. I watch period dramas to forget that I live.
You want to immerse yourself in the world.
I want to immerse myself.
You want to picture yourself in that world.
You know what's more insulting? There's this thing about when some adaptations take a source material and say we're going to upgrade it for the modern world or something. Baz Luhrmann, I think he's like the Australian director or whatever, he did Romeo and Juliet, you know, the Leonardo DiCaprio one. I don't like that adaptation. I don't appreciate what he did with it because it was modern with like Shakespearean language. But I actually appreciate that he's recognized that you don't necessarily need to be in the costumes of the time that Shakespeare wrote Romeo and Juliet or set Romeo and Juliet in, but you can still use the language. And those people spoke in Shakespearean English, whatever, in modern setting and clothing and all that stuff. And it worked for what it was. It shows that the director or writers or whatever, we're not looking at the audience as like if they're dumb and they need the language dumbed down for them. If it's a good story, it will still come across. That's why people watch foreign language films where they have to watch them in subtitled language and still get the rest, the general theme, even if the language is not translating word for word. If you're going to tell me that the best line you can come up with is we are worse than strangers, we are exes.
And then later on she says, world, I have it somewhere here, I'm sure I'll find it.
I'm shaking my head.
She's like, oh yeah, that's the line you're talking about. We are friends.
I
do have a question for you, like comparing like modernism and 18th century, and I even noticed it in the 1995 version and the 2007 version, and it's unfortunate that I can't remember the book as well, so I can actually say what happened. The issue of chaperones in this, like Wentworth and Louise go off on their own whilst their brother accompanies the other sister to visit her suitor. What's his name? Hartley or something like that. And then at the beginning, we have Anne and Wentworth together in a field. I'd assume that this is more because that, you know, they their families didn't approve of their relationship, so probably should sneak away and whatnot. But with the type of character that Anne is, I feel like she's more conservative in a way, and she would not go as far as to meet Wentworth alone in that scenario. I feel like maybe their romance kind of built within like the confines of being around other people kind of thing.
I wish I'd read the book. Sorry? When they were in love when they were younger, or are you talking about now when they're reunited and there's those scenes where they're...
No. The reunited one after they're now like, you know, together, assuming they are married by then. That's okay because they're married. But prior to that, the first scene that we actually see, the opening scene is of Anne and Wentworth in a field together.
I suppose it's sort of...
And even the Louise and Wentworth thing, like walking off together, I saw that in both the
1995
and the 2007 as well.
I can't speak on it too much because I'm thinking it's either, obviously, like you're saying, it's either there's an element of us as modern audiences thinking this chaperoning happened every moment, every day, everything. But I'm sure lovers would sneak away and, you know, enjoy a moment alone.
Because
I remember in Bridgerton, Daphne's mum touches on this, Violet Bridgerton, kind of touches on how, you know, when Daphne comes back and says, oh, mum, we're getting married to with the sudden marriage to Simon. She's like, okay, what has happened? And she sort of alludes to the fact that she's thinking that Daphne and Simon have obviously done something sexual, kissing or something.
Yeah,
she's like, oh, you know, me and your father, we used to sneak away. It's known or whatever. Don't feel bad about it or something. So I think if I think about that, it's kind of like us as a modern audience, maybe we sort of take these rules and think they were like set in stone. But even if you think of us now as people, we have rules, laws or whatever, but people still break them because it is what it is. So that's just my perception, but I don't know if that's necessarily what's in the book, because obviously, like you're saying, if we go back, and I think I would appreciate once we start doing the Jane Austen kind of breakdown and stuff, I would appreciate to go back and really consume her work that way. That's a very interesting point. I'll be very interested to see when we then revisit this, and we'll hope be unfortunately probably revisiting 2022 Persuasion through, but we've already kind of done it. But either way, like, that's interesting.
You're supposed to watch it twice, weren't you? You didn't wanna.
I was gonna say, but I do think though, for the ones where they're walking in the woods, maybe 2022 is a bit hard to sort of get what was going on. But in 1995, I'm very certain that Mary Musgrove is close by as Wentworth and Louisa walk, sort of like near them. They're not right next to them, but they're nearby, even in 2007.
They're visible.
But in 2022, it does make it seem as if they go off on a walk. So I don't know. Maybe the understanding is that there are people around anyway. Like, they're not like they haven't walked to like town and come back. Yeah. It's like they're still walking within the same woods. But that's an interesting... thing. The fourth wall element, right?
It's actually a topic here for me as
that
well.
We have to talk about
you. Go ahead.
I think because I don't have a lot of points on it, so you might then end a lot more. But I was going to say it makes sense technically, right? We have been having a lot of shows, a lot of movies. This is not the first time a fourth wall breaking has ever happened because she's someone who's lonely. She has no one to talk to, so it kind of makes sense as a narrative device to say this person seeks out the voice or the audience. Fleabag does it really well, but Fleabag is a different entity. Fleabag being that show with the priest, the hot priest,
Andrew Scott.
Well, you need to watch Fleabag, by the way. That's a recommendation. But 2007 does it as well. Does the fourth wall break? You know, she looks to camera.
That is different. I was noticing it is different. She looks at the audience, but she's talking internally.
A moment happens and she sort of says, do you see what I mean? But she doesn't say it.
Yes.
She holds it in, and you as an audience member have the room to understand what's going on. You could think she's empathetic. You could actually think sometimes maybe she's even more pathetic for crying and breaking up. But you as an audience member have the agency to think that. It's not Anne coming into the room going, my sister's going to do this. I'm going to speak in Italian. And it comes off very snarky, very mean, very not like Anne as we have seen her in other adaptations. But I was going to say, for me, it's weird that when, what was I going to think of saying? There's a scene when she's, I think, with her sister. The whole, anyway, you go, because I think I might have lost my train of thought, but it was touching on the fact that the 2007 does it in such a different way, does the fourth wall break, but in such a different way that you appreciate it more than get tired of it. Because it, this one happens almost every line that she says is look to camera, look to camera, look to camera, sneak, sneak, snarky, snarky, whatever. 2007 is like here and there. So, yeah.
Yeah. So I will start by, like, you know, because I was like trying to understand why when the scene is trying to communicate a certain emotion, a certain way the character is feeling, the way the audience would react to how that character is feeling or behaving, why when she breaks the fourth wall, I'm immediately taken out of the emotion. It's I'm disconnected from it. So according to Google, if a disadvantage of breaking the fourth wall, done too heavy and it can disrupt the fantasy and drag the reader out of the story. It can overshadow the story too much, reducing tension. It can disrupt the pacing of the novel, if it's the novel that you're reading or watching a TV show or whatnot, and make the reader feel like the story keeps stopping. And that's how I felt sometimes with the fourth wall. Some of the fourth wall dialogue cut through the emotion and tension that they were trying to evoke and did not help these scenes, and it did not help let me dwell within the emotions and what they were trying to convey. So, for example, when she was reading the Wentworth's confession letter in bath, and she is emoting all this heartbreak, joy, relief, and love. And in my head, I'm like, please, no, 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 don't do a fourth wall moment. Do not do it. And then they still did it.
For the entire reading of the letter.
Reading that letter, the reason why I love the 2007 version, and also the, now I enjoy the 1995 version of when she reads that letter. Actually, 95 version doesn't do it as well as I like, but it's far, it's leaps and beyond of what the 22 version is, that either she starts reading and we hear it in her own voice, but she's not reading out loud, it's internal. And then maybe Wentworth's voice kind of
cuts through
and sits in, and maybe that's when she's running or walking or seeking out Wentworth. But with this one, she is reading and she's looking at the audience. And I did not enjoy that at all. I was relieved the one moment when Anne finds out from her lady friend, Lady Russell, that Wentworth is engaged to Louise. And they didn't do the fourth wall break, and it allowed for her heartbreak and for her heartbreak to breathe and for me to feel it as well. And she does eventually look at the camera, but they've allowed a certain time. She's in that tub, right? And she is, I can't remember, is she talking internally or thinking in her head or out loud? Yeah. But she's not looking at the camera. And that helps the scene way more than her having looked into the camera. Let me see, what else do I say? I like the music as well. I think it's the same score that they use when she's swimming at the beach or something like that.
I don't even remember any of the music.
the music that I do remember the most is Birdie at the end.
Oh, yes. That's true.
I actually went to look up that song, and I'm like, add it to my playlist.
No, that song is good. That I would say, of all the irredeemable features of this movie, that music at the end is very good. Birdie's just an sensational voice.
And another fourth wall break that happened, but again, as I said, I went into this thinking it's modern and I'm going to enjoy it for the humor. When they were doing the awkward musical chairs at that dinner where Anne finally is able to join it. And then she, like, I wish there wasn't a fourth wall break after she noisily pulls a chair in and everyone is staring at her. Like, they should have just let us all stand or sit and dwell within the awkwardness until conversation kind of started out again and like, you know, fed in. My bad, my microphone fell.
Now you were getting into the moment.
I was getting into the moment. But yeah, I did not like the fourth wall breaking this. And fourth wall is a very delicate thing to do. It has to be done right. Otherwise, and considering how many times they did it in this movie compared to even the 2007 version, which I understand. I was listening to someone else that they did this for, did they do this for Emma or something?
No, they didn't do it for Emma.
Oh, so maybe I misunderstood that. But with the 2000 version,
Emma. I think it was 1990 something. Kate Beckinsale was Emma, maybe. I could be wrong. I feel like they might have done it for Emma, but I don't think so.
Uh huh.
Not at least but, the 2020 version.
Yeah. I feel like they didn't do it right this one.
It was you're putting too many spices in something and you spoil, like, too many, what is it called? Too many cooks in the kitchen spoil the broth or something like that. I guess I move into more of like the characters a little bit more. Anne and Wentworth, and more specifically starting with. So I would say as a whole, Dakota Johnson, fine actress, like her in other things. She's no Anne for me. She's definitely not an Anne Elliot material, at least in the way she portrayed it. It's not to say Dakota Johnson is not a good actress.
Sorry, before you even continue, there was that Twitter post about how Dakota's face just looks too modern. It looks like she knows how to use a computer. Yes,
exactly. There's just something about the way that period dramas have been able to cast actresses. And you can actually tell. Even Keira Knightley fell into the same problem, where because the movie had, for me,
really? With Pride and Prejudice?
Yeah, with Pride and Prejudice. In terms of, she even said it as in, like, the director was telling her to, like, look a certain way or whatever, because she looked very modernish. So they had to, like, downplay. Okay. And the thing is, the problem here is because period dramas always run into that weird dynamic of, like, should we use the bonnets? Should we not use the bonnets? Especially for, like, Regency era dramas, right? Mm-hmm. They're obviously trying to show the beauty of these actresses and not fall too much into the dowdy look that the bonnets and stuff usually can result in. But at the end of the day, I would say, to me personally, I prefer the way, for example, 1995 Pride and Prejudice dresses its actresses, because they have the hair up and everything. It's not down all the time. It's down at appropriate times. It's down at that is important, because if you're thinking of, for example, I remember there was a scene where I was watching, I used to love The Tudors, that show with
I watched a little bit of it.
So in The Tudors, there's a scene where Henry comes to see his wife, I think it's his third wife, Jane Seymour, whatever, and he sees her washing her hair. And the significance of that scene, I don't even know if it was played like this, but I remember it that way, because he's looking at her as this beautiful thing that's come into his life, because at that time he's like killed his second wife and he's lost his first wife or whatever. But
that was wild, man. That,
so crazy. But either way, he's looking at this woman like she's this redeeming thing that he's got, and she's washing her hair. And hair is such an important, but that's why in some religions people cannot see some people's hair, because it has connotations to it. For me, the way that they just make Anne have hair out all the time, it just okay, let me just get into it and be really serious, because I feel like I'm going all over the place.
Guys, she's actually sending herself to properly, like, get into it.
I am. So for me, Anne comes across as, Anne is portrayed by Dakota Johnson, comes across more of an Elizabeth Bennet mixed in with Emma, because she's got this confidence, this self-assuredness, this I don't care, the world can do whatever, I'll do whatever I want, I'm a one-woman show, strong woman all the way attitude that these characters have. But they're written that way because they're 21 and 19 or something. That is the time period, that is the age that Emma and Elizabeth Bennet are. And it makes sense for them because they're not women that are jaded by a world where they're now looked at as spinsters, as people left on the shelf in this world, right? Because Anne Elliot lost her love, is now considered a spinster, and has no hope, perhaps, in her world of potentially finding a love, because she's still holding on to that love. But also, even the possibility of her marrying someone is now really, really slim, because she's being overshadowed by the Louisas and the Henriettas, because they're the ones coming into the world. So for me, Anne never goes through a transformation, right? That is one of the biggest things that happens. Even in the 2007 adaptation, you see Sally Hawkins start off as this, like, not so fresh-faced person. And then she does go through her second bloom. Similarly, Amanda Root, who plays Anne Elliot in the 1995 version, is even more significantly a transformation-type character, because obviously, I think the cinematography at the time allowed for this to be the case, but she just looks like she has no makeup, anything like that on her face. And then when they start going to bath and she looks much more fresh and everything, you can actually tell she's got some makeup on her face. She looks brighter. She looks happier.
Yes.
She's coming into her own, and it makes so much more of a difference, rather than the way they dressed up Dakota Johnson's end, because she's wearing men's trench coats, she's got her hair down, she's wearing berets, she's wearing Victorian wear for some reason in the 18th century. And I'm just like, what is going on?
And then
on one really specific point, for example, they're trying to do something different, right? She's a wine drinker. I accept that. You know, you're someone who's drowning your sorrows.
Thank you. That's the point I'm actually looking at. I'm like, what?
I will actually like let you then talk in that one. I was just going
to
say.
No, it's not like, it's just merely a comment to say like, there's that scene when she can't go to the first dinner where Frederick is at because she's watching over her nephew who fell. And she's drinking wine. And she calls, she calls out to Frederick. Anne wouldn't do that. Not in a million years. And then as she hides, the wine spills on her. And I'm like, why is it even there? She should not even drink it like that. What is happening with this character? Again, it's a little thing to nitpick on, but no, you go ahead. Like, it was just that one thing.
For me, it goes down to the fundamentals. We're trying to show a character and maybe a flaw or a trait that they have, right?
Yes.
The wine drinking might make sense for someone who's trying to drown their sorrows. I'm just going to read what I wrote, by the way, because then it would make sense rather than me going off. But I wish it had been done more tastefully.
Yeah.
Not because we're working with what we have. So she's a wine drinker in this movie. Let's work with the wine drinking.
Yes, yes.
For me, maybe we could have actually had a scene or two where Wentworth picks up on this drinking habit that she has, right? Or something to show that he still cares for her. Like he's still like concerned maybe for her in this weird anger.
He knows her and this is a change or departure from her character.
If you remember, there is that thing that says, where he says to her, she was so altered, he could not even recognize her. It's in this movie, it's said when they're at the piano, for some reason, Mary comes to tell her in a more snarky way that Wentworth said that. That's fine to say that. But it doesn't follow through because for me, the way they played that dinner scene, that cringeworthy dinner scene that should have never happened considering Anne's characterization, but the way they played it, where she's awkward and she's saying all these stupid things, would have made sense.
Yes, like her pointing out that she was married to...
She was almost married to Charles Mouse
Grove. Adaptations, it's not even her who says it.
Exactly.
It's other people.
Exactly. It just does not make sense, but they're doing this because they're saying she's a drunkard in this movie for some reason. So, yes, she's a drunkard. Wentworth notices that something is off with her rather than her looks, because in this movie, her looks don't even change. So you notice some behavior thing. Let's use that to the advantage of the movie by having him notice it. Because why would you have such a key behavioral trait or thing and not use it in a way that allows the couple to somehow be drawn together, if that makes sense? Because the reason why I'm saying this is, like, if you think of those movies where the sob story where like someone is an addict or something and someone comes and saves them, I'm thinking more of that, because that's why else would you have her be a drinker and no one calls her out on it and nothing is addressed at the end of the movie? She doesn't show that she drinks less. It's just done away with as
a character. I think they made it like into a quirk and like a comedic quirk, like, you know, and it never had actual any significance to or any depth to it.
Because
and that's why they didn't even decide what the movie was gonna be.
Because you're trying to appeal to the modern woman. Great. The strong modern woman. I don't like this trope. Never liked it, because I think strength comes in many ways. It can be silence, as Anne portrays, it can be confidence or overconfidence as Elizabeth portrays, it can be, you know, the self-assuredness of character as Emma portrays, you know, because she's thinking she can match make everyone and she's confident in who she is, you know. It can be sort of like the naive but like very what do you call it, warm what's her name, the Northanger Abbey character, whatever, Catherine Middleton. Gosh, I was Morton? No.
Morland?
I keep forgetting her name, but she's... Isn't she Catherine, though?
Wait. Nothing.
I'm sorry, guys. I just haven't watched or rewatched Nothing Abbey in a while, although I love J.J. Fielding, but anyway, it's crazy. And what is it with these Englishmen that have, like, names that almost look like something we can say, but then it is actually
spelled... Catherine Morland.
Morland. Thank God I was on the money there by the end, at the end at least. And, you know, you've got your Fanny Price as well, who's coming in there with her own strength. So all these women that Jane Austen portrays.
I'm sorry, Fanny Price has the strength?
No, no, I'm saying as in, I don't think she necessarily has the strength, but whatever little sauce that Jane Austen.
She has nothing. She has nothing.
Why did you ruin my moment of putting through the heroines? I know. Fanny Price is hard for me because I don't enjoy Mansfield Park as much, but I can see where Fanny Price can fit into the spectrum of Jane Austen's characters. Anyway, that's a discussion for another day. Yeah. But all I was trying to highlight is there are these key traits that make these women strong or significant in some way that's not making them all the same character. And Elliot has no distinct characterization in this movie. So that's where I was like, the wine drinking thing could have been used in a much more significant way than they did use it, because it just went nowhere. And I just, anyway, you can say something else. Yeah. I'm frustrated as hell.
What was Dakota doing with her face?
Oh, God.
So
it's as if she's in 50 Shades of Grey, but she forgot that this is a different kind of movie. Oh, God.
Throughout the whole film, she has this smirk on her face, this look of amusement on her face that she exudes throughout the whole film. And sometimes I was like, why are you this way? Like, what's happening? In some scenes and moments, it works, because there are scenes where she has to show amusement, or that scene when she's smirking when she first gets to the... to her sister's house, mm-hmm. and she's like, before I even say anything, Mary is gonna say blah, this, and it happens, and she smirks. It works, right? And then there's this scene when she's at the beach with Wentworth, and they're finally having a long overdue talk about Wentworth.
I think Wentworth that was not even worthy of a scene, but we'll get into that. <You go.
laughs> Wentworth approaches her, right? And he's like, he's talking about how he's been, like, you know, an a-hole per se, and you know, like, how overprotective he's been with her, but also pretty and all that stuff, right? And he's like, you know, let's reconcile, let's be friends kind of thing. And he's being serious. His face is doing what it's supposed to do. It's exuding some heartbreak. It's exuding some sadness. It's exuding, like, hope. There is something happening with his face that fits well with what's happening, the emotion that he's trying to portray in this moment. But then you have Dakota's Anne. She is smirking. Like, there's something funny happening every time they cut to her face. I'm like, do you hear what he's saying? Or are you, I don't know, what's happening in your head? Like, and the scene was calling for more solemnity, if I'm saying that word right. Yes. Oh, and she's just doing her own thing. And it just removes me from whatever this man is trying to, like, you know, he's trying to have a moment, and she just won't have it.
Oh, God. You know what, though? I think for me, if we're going to touch on the Wentworth side of things, I will just outright say this, guys, I did not like this actor as Wentworth at all. It's not only the look that they try to go for him. They try to give him this seasoned naval officer look. But if I'm not mistaken, this is a guy that is supposed to have gone through an evolution to be this handsome,
handsome is how you described. That's why the 2007 version is like...
To be honest with you, I don't like Rupert Penry-Jones because he's blonde. I don't have a thing for blondes. But I like
handsome. No, but you recognize that he's good looking, handsome.
I would say Kieran Hines is... Like, Kieran Hines being the guy. I think it's Kieran because he's Irish, so I think their C is a K. Anyway, Kieran Hines...
Sorry, I'm sorry, wait. The 1995 version?
1995 version has got Kieran Hines in it as an actor.
That's Wentworth, right?
No, that's Wentworth, like him more. Like, he is my ideal Wentworth. I know that's like an attraction thing, but I'm just saying that's how I picture my Wentworth when I look at... And this is, to be honest with you, Kieran Hines...
He was good looking to you?
To me, he was good looking.
Don't try to walk past this.
No, I'm not walking past...
I'm
trying... You're trying to emphasize that he's not good looking to you, but I'm saying the only reason I don't like Rupert Perry-Jones is... He's got this blonde look that I tend not to like in men that are blonde. I don't have things for white men much anyway, but I don't really find him as attractive to me as I would find Kieran Hines. And mind you, this is because you have to remember, I like the 1995 adaptation. So all the things about it work for me. So I know Kieran Hines is not for everybody, but I like Kieran Hines. Especially what I can remember most distinctly in the 1995 version is when Wentworth walks into the concert hall. And they've got this lighting and everything. And he looks so good in his suit. And he just exudes this confidence. And you're just like, damn. Yes. He has come out of the Navy and he's rich and he doesn't care about what everyone is saying. This guy.
He looks dashing. He looks smart. Like that I can.
Yeah. Like that's what. Yeah. It's got nothing to do necessarily with the looks. I don't think. I'm not saying. Let's scrape the way we approach this. I'm not saying Cosmo Jarvis doesn't look good in any way. I don't think necessarily it's a handsomeness thing. I think it's more so the energy that you have to exude. There's so many actors that are nothing like the typical model look that we expect sometimes. Why I keep saying Rupert Penry Jones for me is pretty. I don't like pretty men. If you've noticed, we've always had this conversation where I'm like, I like this actor. You're like, oh my God, but they're this. That's because that's the kind of man I like. I don't like the pretty guy. Like, that's not me. I appreciate prettiness, but I don't like that type of, like, look for a man, I suppose. But anyway, regardless, it's not a look thing. Going back for listeners out there, we're not talking about the looks per se. I'm talking specifically about the energy that Wentworth is supposed to exude. He's someone who, 7 years down the line, and 7 years before, sorry, he didn't have the money. He was poor. He had no prospects. And he was rejected by the love of his life. He would have probably gone out into the world resentful and angry, and he's still angry at Anne and all that stuff. But he makes the money. He has the status now. So he shows it. And it is even shown from the moment 1995 shows it. He walks into the door. Boom. Captain Wentworth. 2007 shows it. Boom. Captain Wentworth. 2022.
He did not exude whatever energy. He seemed like a nervous wreck.
Literally, was just like, why are we... The funny thing is, they're almost taking some characteristics of a Darcy. Like, sort of like, sometimes the awkwardness that Darcy has in an audience, right? Like, not awkwardness as in, like, he's... You know how people say... Or at least the people that I've followed say sometimes they think... In a modern interpretation, Darcy could almost have, like, not a behavioral issue, but he could just be, like, one of those guys that's, like, I'm just awkward in a crowd, but I'm very confident when I'm at Pemberley kind of thing. But he's still a confident man. He still walks into the room and everybody's, like, Mr. Darcy kind of thing. But it's almost like they wanted to take that for Darcy, like, the awkwardness he sometimes portrays to people because he doesn't want to talk to people. But the difference is Mr. Darcy doesn't need to talk to people. He's just confident and he walks into a room and everybody loves him. Wentworth now walks into the room and I'm just like, what are we doing? And the way he dresses, why are we making him dress like he's a merchant? He's a naval officer. Why not put him in naval officer
type gear? The 95 and the 2007 version, he is dressed to the nines.
Literally, like, he would have the best tailors. He would be able to walk into the best shop, get the best tailors. He would be able to get, like, the hair done. I don't mind the sideburns. Yeah, I appreciate it's of the time, because even 1995 and 2007 kind of get rid of the sideburns a little bit. But either way, he just looks like he's just dirty. Like, I'm sorry, but, like, you know, I'm just like, I'm sorry. I had to say it. I'm sorry.
Why?
He just looks like I should have just shut up. I'm so sorry. First of all, I went into this whole Luke tangent and then Luke's tangent, and Tinashe was calling me out on my love for Kieran Hines. Yes, I think Kieran Hines is the most handsome Wentworth.
You did not call that character dirty. Like, you look dirty.
But he just doesn't look put together. That's hilarious. He doesn't look put together. At the beginning, when he's wearing his naval officer suit or something, or maybe at the end, sorry, he looks like, that's what I want. Like, even when he's walking down the street and she's chasing after him, I'm just saying, he looks so sad. He just looks so sad. And I didn't understand why they had to have him portray himself like that. Because this is a guy who's so angry at Anne that he's almost using his status now as a way to say, do you see what you lost out on kind of thing? Yes.
The richness. That he makes a point, like, you know, he's now rich. And if, especially when he walks into the breakfast thing and he's like, when they have that weird interaction at breakfast when it comes to introducing himself, because Anne wasn't there at the dinner, and he's like, you know, not before I was handsome or something like that, you know, because she, and he's like, oh, you look so old and whatnot, and like, you know, I can't remember quite how the conversation goes. Then he's like, at the very least, he's handsome, kind of thing. Yeah. And I'm like, apparently you look dirty, sir.
I'm sorry. It's just the way, because I just compared the 2007 and 1995, and they just had Wentworth. Anyway, that's all I had to say about Wentworth. I was not going to just, like, delve more into, like as I guess, the interactions for me specifically. When we, I'm doing this in order, so you are welcome to revert the order I did them, it did them in. But you talked about the breakfast, and it sort of alludes to what I want to talk about in terms of, like, Anne never looks affected by what happened to her unless she's just randomly emoting, crying, whatever. The reason why I'm saying this is when she first hears, if you think about 2007 and 1995, when she first hears that the Crofts are going to rent Kellynch Hall and she connects who the Crofts are related to,
yeah,
it physically affects her. In the 1995 one, she literally has to get up and pretend to take tea or something because she can't speak. Yes. In the 2007 one, she has to leave the room because she's physically affected by finding out that someone who she thought she might never see again is coming back into her life. And she, outside of the specks of news that she hears about him, this is the first reminder of him being, like, back or alive or out in her world, kind of thing. Something she never thought would happen. But this version plays it like it's nothing. The scene happens, and Dakota Johnson might as well. I mean, I get what they might have been trying to do to have her look like she's unaffected, and then she cries in her bedroom. But even then, I didn't feel any emotion much with her crying for him, like, afterwards.
It's more, I think, what doesn't help the scene, does the fourth wall break again there as well? She's talking to the audience, like, what you're saying about the 99 version and 2007 version, they don't even have the fourth wall break. Like, you can see it. They emote.
Like, the crazy. Exactly. they act it out. Like, it's supposed to be acted out. Because then it carries over for me into the first meeting. 1995 and 2007, they have so much tension in that first meeting. As you said, in the 2007 one, he walks in the door. She immediately turns away because she just can't handle it. She's like, what the hell? Is he? You know, like, think about when you want avoiding someone you know you want to meet, but you also want to avoid, and the reaction you usually do is flight. It's usually a flee reaction. You want to just run away from the scene. You don't want to confront it head on. 1995 does something similar. She literally physically holds onto the chair as she's standing. I always love that scene because it's awkwardly shot. Like, it's like, hold onto the chair, then cut back to the actress. But anyway, it evokes what's supposed to be done, that she's physically affected by him walking in. In 2007, she turns away until Mary addresses the fact that, you know, Wentworth keeps looking to Anne. She's like, oh, you know, this is my sister. And then she turns around and she just can't look at him. She's like, we were acquainted. And then, you know, Mary's like, oh, I didn't know you were acquainted. And Wentworth is angry. Like, he bites his jaw. Like, what the heck? He never even talked about me, kind of thing.
Yes.
And, like, in the 1995 one, he's just, like, dismissive because he's like, well, whatever, you know. I'm back now. Like, he's trying to act cool, but he's not. He's angry. But 2022, I don't even remember this scene because it's just some stupid jam and bucket on the head.
Oh. Girl, not only that, the conversation, the dialogue that they have. I think I paused the movie for a bit and I looked to the side, but I live alone. But I really wanted, like, to be like, can anyone see this? Does anyone see this? What the hell is happening? Why are they having Anne again? The characterization of Anne in this, as I said, I went into this movie and I'm like, this is like a modern retelling of the show, of the movie. And even though I said that to myself, I'm like, this conversation would never have happened in the book or and it didn't happen in any of the adaptations because one, Anne was too mortified to even talk about, what did she say? You look old.
Why was he even walking in at that particular moment? Was Charles Musgrove there? Because if I'm not mistaken, in 2007 and 1995, Charles is there and they're heading out to hunt or something. And he's coming to meet them because he's just been to Kellen Chore.
Yeah, Chelsea's and there. Stuff. Chelsea's so in there.
Is he in the 2022 one?
Yes, well? Yes, oh, okay. Yeah. I can't remember if he was in there, but he comes to collect him or he's already in there as well. Oh,
okay,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
well, yeah, that is that. I can't nitpick at that one then, but. Oh, it was very energy inducing. Oh, actually, energy draining and energy inducing in trying to not make me jump because I didn't react, but I was just like, this is really awkward. But then what also took me out is because if you think about like what I was talking about, the chemistry thing, and I'm trying to run through so we don't keep going on and on. But the fact that there's not enough touching in this movie, right? And the reason why I'm saying it is if you think of 2007, 1995, there are moments where either 2007, I think Anne falls and Wentworth helps her up and he helps into the carriage. 1995, yeah, yeah. He helps into the carriage, stuff like that. Because before that, there's been little to no interactions between the two of these. So this is a big hint for us as audience members, right? That although Wentworth is angry, there is still something he feels towards
Anne. He can't Anne. Help he himself cares. Wanting to touch her so or help exactly. her or anything.
He's,
yeah.
he's very much noticing. And he's giving her attention, unlike most people in her family. So 1995 yes. and 2007, like I say, take the opportunity to just let us see like that he still cares. And as I used the example, 2007, legit, he like drags her and like carries her onto the carriage. And then Sally Hawkins does this little gasp. And I'm just like, yes, because he's like everything. Because she's like, oh, my God, he's touching me. And like 1995, Amanda Root is just shocked. And when like Kieran Hines like, doesn't drag, he just genitely prods her to go to the carriage.
Yeah, like his hand is on
yeah on her back and he also yeah. helps her up. She's just looking at him like shocked, like he touched me. And 2007 obviously has the moment where Sally actually kind of speaks to the audience, because in the beauty about 2007 is they diarize her thoughts, right? So unlike 2022 where they're trying to get her to talk to the audience, in 2007 she's talking to the audience through her diary, so it kind of makes sense.
We're not
getting the fourth wall break yeah. as talking, we're getting it as looks, but we get the words on the paper because it's yes. her thoughts. And I like yeah, that yeah. she then says he's still angry at me, but then and the moment gets the thought process actually gets interrupted because her sister starts talking or whatever, but that yeah. but then is kind of I think an allusion to the fact that she's noticed that he seems to be giving her attention. So she knows he's angry at her, but she's also like, oh, but then he just like extended a kindness to me kind of thing. But then in 2022, you've got this weird, this weird moment where she's fallen down and I guess someone has noticed it. We never get to see that anyone has noticed her fall because it's meant to just be a stupid comedic moment once again.
Yeah, yeah.
But then when they get and to the carriage.
And she still has that smirk on her face.
Literally, oh, look at me. I've fallen down. Life is so hard. But then they get to the carriage. And yes, he tells the Crofts that she's hurt. But it's a moment of like, oh, Anne, just don't be stubborn. Get in the carriage. He doesn't touch her. He doesn't help her up. This is a gentleman in the 18th century. What else is he designed to do but help a woman in need?
Damn.
Oh my God.
Pause. If anyone, like hardcore feminists, were listening to this.
I'm sorry to the feminists out there, but I'm talking about a piece of art and work that was written for its time, and I accept the confines of that time.
Right, and I love it.
Because I'm thinking this was a perfect. Bridgerton showed us you do not need sex, you do not need overt words and yes. speeches, you just yes. need looks and hints yeah. and touches. And when they talk to each other, they're talking in such cryptic ways that you're like, just get to the point. But it is burning. I'm sorry, I know I'm like literally just bouncing off my bed, but I am so frustrated by how they used a book which has so many perfect slow burn opportunities and just did away with them. I'm going to get to one of the worst scenes that when I rewatched, I was like, I cannot believe this is happening. But anyway, I don't know if you had any more to talk about the touching and the touches in this movie.
You know, I almost wanted to say, like, I thought they tried to do the Pride and Prejudice thing, like the hand thing. They never touched.
I was literally, no, they did. I watched this again yesterday. She goes into the carriage. She's walking up and they say whatever they say. And even Louisa gets involved going, oh, Anne, your pride, whatever. And then she just walks into the carriage and that's it. And they look at each other. But it's not even a significant look. It's not. Wentworth in 2007 helps her and he sort of looks frustrated with himself for even like giving into that desire.
Yep,
1995, similarly, he tries to play it off as if it's just nothing. But you can tell this is a calculated move to try to help Anne that is also kind of working against him trying to not give in. Because if you think about it, if these are people that were so in love and he was so in love with her, I think men have this thing where, like, if they've been so heartbroken, they'll definitely have, like, a... I'm just generalizing men, by the way. But as in their way of, like, showing that frustration is very different to how women might show it. But I think men then fear that heartbreak again. So I think he's fearing going back into her orbit. And so by helping her and touching her and whatever, he's kind of, you know, drawing himself. Maybe he's resisting. I don't know. I mean, that's my interpretation, I know. But in 2022, they did not do that. I don't know why I'm saying 2022, but yeah, that's what I'm saying.
We're in the future right now.
Yes. That concludes part one of this episode of The Story Never Ends. Check out part two for more.